This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about the latest season of Que Pasa Midwest, the bilingual podcast for Indiana's Hispanic community based out of WNIN in Evansville. This season is focused on recovery from COVID-19, physical recovery, economic recovery, addressing mental health issues, all the ways Hoosiers have been forced to adapt and survive the last year. If you have any questions or comments for our show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We're joined now by two people behind the podcast. Paula Marizan is a multimedia journalist and producer and host at WNIN, and Maria Thomas is director of digital media at WNIN. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Paula, there are so many ways the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted people's lives over the last year. How did you decide what to focus on for this season of Que Pasa Midwest?
You know, I think it was really a team conversation that we had. There are so many issues that we could have gone with, but we really want to focus on what's happening now and how the community is being affected now. For every season, we always have discussions, you know, what are the most pressing matters? What are we hearing from our community? So I think one of the things why we wanted to go with how people are recovering from COVID-19 in many areas. I think it was because, you know, we saw that it was at the forefront. It was something that was happening within our communities, in our schools, in our churches, everywhere we went, it was there, it was present. And there was no way to even avoid the conversation. So I think, you know, we just wanted to just go full front with it and see what people, how people were feeling, how they were doing, what they were doing, you know, within their own communities, how they were helping, how they were recovering. I think it was just a team conversation and being aware of what our community was going through at that moment.
Mm-hmm. And Maria, the first episode of the season is about how the pandemic highlighted the need for better healthcare options for pregnant women. What did you learn working on that? Did anything surprise you at all?
Yes, one thing. So Amy, the person who is in that episode, is actually a nurse herself, and she talks about how difficult and the stigma around trying to get government medical care, basically, even though that's what she does for a living, is she helps other pregnant women do this. And the difficulty of, she already had a kid, being a mom and then also being pregnant at the same time and making the difficult decision that I can't do my job. I need to stay home. I need to take care of my kid and, you know, focus on me for once. And it was just how the hoops you have to jump through just to try to take care of yourself sometimes, even in a pandemic, you know. And she is fluent in English, and she had issues with this. So how much more difficult is that process for people when English isn't their first language, you know? So just the concern about the lack of language options available for something as crucial as healthcare.
Mm-hmm. And I think the pandemic highlighted so many things in so many different realms this past year and a half. And it sounds like with this topic specifically, we're looking at these language barriers that were highlighted and not enough options. Is that fair to say?
Yes, for sure. Definitely.
And Paula, for the second episode, you worked with reporter Christine Herman, who's with Side Effects Public Media in Illinois. Can you tell us a little bit about the story with the young woman that was featured and what happened to her?
Yeah, so for our second episode, we actually worked with Christine, like you mentioned, and we talked about Mayra Ramirez. And Mayra is 28 years old. She unfortunately contracted the virus. And, you know, she was a healthy young woman before then. So a lot of us really didn't think, you know, being young, maybe this is not going to affect me as much. But she actually had to undergo a double lung transplant after contracting the virus. Not only did she had severely damaged her lungs because of COVID-19, but afterwards she had, you know, some underlying issues and some ongoing issues within, you know, after the transplant. She had I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name of the actual infection right now, but she actually had an infection after the surgery. And it was just kind of all tied together. So it was really, really sad to see that something like that happened to somebody so young and vibrant before then. She actually works with the immigrant community as well. So she helped the immigrant community, and now she is recovering. She has gone back to work. She's definitely working with the immigrant community, helping them with some legal documents and paperwork, and she's gone back to, trying to live a normal life, which she has described. It's been really challenging, not only for her but also for her family, because with contracting COVID and having the first double lung transplant, it has, come with bills. So that's something that she's also having to deal with.
And Maria, the third episode is about students dealing with COVID-19 and the impact the pandemic has had on education. You spoke with Cassandra and Cesar. What did you learn speaking with them?
Yes, so one thing that Cassandra talks about is trying to, stay in school and keep up with your studies and everything, even though all of a sudden, and Cesar talked about too, that how important it was to actually have that in-person relationship with your professors, with your mentors, and then suddenly it's just gone. All of a sudden, losing that sense of physical community, not being able to meet for clubs and things. And then Cassandra was also concerned about her parents and their health as well. So on top of the anxiety of being in school during a pandemic, you also have the concern for your loved ones who are at risk and their health and their safety, and then the financial stability. There are just so many different aspects that students and education professionals were having to encounter due to the changes like working from home or learning from home that happened with the pandemic.
Did you get a sense from students facing challenges that they had enough resources available to them or any kind of help, whether it was at school or through a local organization?
Paula, could you speak to that a little bit?
No, I think, there was a lot of things going on, things changing all the time within like school and with other restrictions happening. So, like Maria mentioned, there was a lot of uncertainty from the students and just the school trying to kind of accommodate everyone. So I think that what mainly we saw in that episode was that a lot of students were actually struggling with mental health issues because they didn't get that sense of community, that sense of togetherness that they usually get when they are, on campus. And one thing that was mentioned multiple times is how for international students or immigrant students, having that extra, togetherness at school and being part of the international club or the Latinx club, it really helps. It just makes you feel more at home. I think it makes you feel like, you can speak your language, you can talk to people about your experiences and what's going on. If you have an issue, like Cesar mentioned on the story, you can just come into his office and talk about it. But after COVID and, with all the restrictions and everyone trying to be safe, I think there was that lack of community, that sense of community. So a lot of the students were dealing with a lot of mental health issues.
I do want to talk a little bit about the vaccine and how impacted the Hispanic community was in the Midwest and in Indiana. I know one of the episodes you did, Paula, on farm workers talked about getting the vaccine out. What did you learn from that? Were there enough efforts made to make sure that everybody was having access to this?
I think, we learned that there wasn't enough efforts. That story came from Dana Cronin and Christine Herman as well, and they are with the Side Effects Public Media Group. And they were the ones who talked to the farm workers, and we got to hear them talking to some immigrant workers that have been coming to the United States for more than 10 years. And they say, how things have changed, how things have, that migration has become so much harder for them because of COVID. After being here, they were fortunate that they actually got the vaccine. I mean, 3 days from being in the United States, they were vaccinated. And we learned that, you know, it was so important for them to get vaccinated because of the conditions where they work. You know, they're right next to each other in the fields. Some of them have shared housing where they share communal areas. So, you know, knowing that so many people have died from COVID, and actually in the agricultural industry, it has been a large number because at the beginning, it wasn't as accessible as it is now. So we learned that, you know, they were really thankful to, they said the United States, they said the government, they were really thankful to the government because of the opportunity. And they actually spoke about the difference between coming from Mexico, where the vaccine wasn't as available and wasn't, you know, there wasn't a lot of information on the vaccines that they are producing in the country. The difference as to coming here and being able to speak to people about it, being able to receive the vaccine. They did say that some of their coworkers or the people that they know that work in other farms did not receive the vaccine as fast as they did. But, you know, for them, they were just very thankful about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to ask you before we wrap up here, what is next for this season? Maria, do you have any ideas on what you're going to cover?
Yes. So in episode 6, you hear the beginning about the efforts of a University of Evansville Change Lab class who started working to get information out to Latinos about the COVID-19 virus and the COVID-19, specifically the vaccine in Spanish. And then they took it a step further and decided to help out with a vaccine clinic, which took place at the church. So episode 7 is actually, we went to the vaccine clinic. It happened after the Spanish Mass. And you're going to hear from some of the people who actually got the vaccine there, from Father Martin, who's in episode 6, but he's also in episode 7, Cindy Crow, the professor of the class, and possibly Kelly Paul, who works with Ascension St. Vincent and helped get this all set up, and what it took to make this happen, to make that clinic happen, and why it was so important. And honestly, this is the first thing that I did in person since the pandemic, and it was just a really amazing experience to see in action Latino community getting health care brought to them instead of them having to overcome all these obstacles, the language barriers and transportation and all that, just to make sure that they stay safe.
I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about the latest season of Que Pasa Midwest, a bilingual podcast based out of WNIN in Evansville. Season 6 is underway, and its theme is recovery. We talked to the producers behind the podcast in the first segment. Now, we're going to talk to a few of the people featured in the show. If you have any questions or comments on the show, find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us now is Amy Gastelum, a registered nurse who talked to Que Pasa Midwest about her experience during the pandemic. Welcome, Amy. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Amy, take us back to when the pandemic first hit. What was your workday like at that time?
Oh, my goodness. I remember, what my work generally was I was making home visits to women who were pregnant until their baby was 2 years old. So relationship-based home visiting program. So generally I was out in the field and I was at people's homes and making visits and talking with babies and moms. And the week that all the schools got shut down, which was like in late March, I remember having a team meeting on Thursday, and then the very next day, you know, my child's school got shut down, everybody's school got shut down, and we stopped making home visits, and everything went to using, video, encrypted video to have our visits. It was wild.
And so, I mean, what was that like, the shift in your job from what you were doing right before then to just suddenly having to change everything?
Well, you know, our program was basically to kind of help build self-efficacy among new moms and just be that kind of sidekick to her as she becomes a mom, you know, and her role changes and she needs, you know, to develop herself in that way. So it went from, you know, having these, you know, in-depth conversations about parenting and life, you know, just life skills to, you know, I was making drops of food and diapers, and strapping my kid into her car seat, you know, in the back seat because she was not in school. And just making kind of these emergency deliveries of these absolutely necessary items. So we just kind of had to triage and shift a bit.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that it changed sort of, I don't know if it would change the role, but in person was probably, you know, the best way to interact with people when they're having a new baby or they're going through these changes versus a screen. Did you feel a difference at all in that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I even had to enroll clients over the phone. So I'm saying, hey, you don't know me, but let's, you know, let me into your life over the phone for 3 years, you know? And so it's like, how do you build rapport that quickly in that manner? And some people didn't want to use video either. So then it was just on the phone. But we made it work. Like, I was really impressed. I actually was able to develop some really, really good relationships within the 4 months that I was working during the pandemic, even just over video or over the phone. Mm-hmm.
Did you notice that the pandemic impacted the folks that you were working with? You know, I mean, obviously it impacted everyone. I guess I'm wondering what kind of impact you saw.
So the moms that I was working with qualified for the program because they either qualified for Medicaid or WIC. So it's income determinant. So they were generally low income women, you know. And because I speak Spanish, I worked with a lot of immigrant women who did not speak English. And so, as we know, like, you know, immigrants have all different kinds of status when they come. They could maybe be here on a visa or have a green card even, or and some are undocumented. And I would definitely say that my undocumented clients were impacted extremely hard, like the hardest of anyone, because, you know, a lot of them, most of my clients who are undocumented were working, obviously. And when people were laid off, I mean, they were just off the books because they weren't even ever on the books. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was like loss of income like that. And no stimulus check coming, no unemployment benefits coming. You're just gone. It's like you never existed. That was really hard to witness.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know what to say to think about how different people were going through things. And then there's a class of people that we don't even think about.
Yeah. But their labor is definitely felt and used by our entire population. That's for sure. So we do feel that impact, you know, on some level. It's just very, very silent, mm-hmm. very mm-hmm. quiet.
Did you feel that people were given enough information at the time, the folks that you were working with, or?
Yeah, I'll be honest, at the time, nobody was getting good information. I mean, nobody, you know, it was late March, you know, when this first was happening. And so everyone was confused. We referred to the CDC, you know, and the CDC has their information translated into several languages. So that was really convenient to be able to just kind of text a link that was in Spanish. Now, you have to consider not all of my clients necessarily can read even in Spanish, and Spanish might not even be their first language. Mm-hmm. So it was extremely challenging to convey what is social distancing? How do you do it? I mean, I had trouble helping my mom figure that stuff out. So, you know, helping my clients who come from a different culture and different language barriers, it was a huge challenge for sure.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Indiana is prepared at all to tackle language barriers?
That's a big question for somebody with a higher pay scale than me. I would have to do a lot of research to be able to answer that question more effectively. I'm not sure.
But from your experience, I mean, did you feel like overall people were able to get the information that they needed, or is there still like a lag in materials?
Yeah. And my experience is so limited to the clients that I had. I mean, I had about 30 clients, and I'm in central Indiana. So I'm limited to that experience that I had, but I would say, you know, even getting health care for my population, it was a challenge, you know. And so did my clients have a primary care provider that they could go to for basic information? Not always, not often at all. And, you know, I know that Paola and Maria were talking about mental health care. I mean, forget about it. And in my, you know, work, we definitely deal in mental health in terms of perinatal mood disorders and that kind of thing. And, you know, that's always been a challenge to find practitioners that speak Spanish and can provide therapy in Spanish. It's a huge challenge for Central Indiana for sure. And so there's going to be a lot of fallout, I think, in terms of mental health, that my former clients are going to definitely, you know, could benefit from, and it just won't be available. So definitely for mental health.
Yeah, I think we're seeing that across the board and in so many different groups of people that the pandemic has hit really hard. What about for you and your career? You were working with these clients, pandemic hit. What happened after that? Did you have to shift your career? Did you leave?
Yeah, so Miriam, I know how to think on my feet. I've been a public health nurse for 10 years. So I know how to think on my feet. And in this case, I had to think on my feet for myself. So I was trying to do this job via video, and my daughter's school was essentially, you know, all from home. And she's 7 years old, and she was, you know, she was losing her mind trying to watch the Zoom screen. And I was in the other room translating job interviews for clients, because that was another thing that I was doing, because there just weren't enough translators. So I was doing everything, you know, whatever I could do for my clients. And my daughter went missing. I got off the call and I went in the living room and I was like, where is she? She had just left the house without telling anyone and was on a kind of a walk, I guess, around the neighborhood. And I called the police, and there was, you know, the hunt for my daughter, which we found her very quickly and everything. But when that happened, I was like, this is not sustainable. Like, this is dangerous at this point. I can't do this. I cannot divide my attention like this. So I applied for graduate school, as as one does, because I was like, I can get student loans, you know, and it's a lot more flexible than this job. The job was flexible in its way, but it was very intense. And I was like, I can go to graduate school and it won't be nearly as intense as this. And I can give my child the attention that she needs. I can get the money that I need for now. And then I got pregnant very soon after that, and ended up applying for Medicaid. And so that's kind of what the piece in K-PASA Midwest kind of focuses around, my experience of going from helping clients, you know, apply for Medicaid and helping their, you know, get their children qualified for Medicaid, and then having to do it myself.
And what was that transition like for you, to go from helping others to then being in need of help?
It really highlighted for me the way that I think that shame is kind of built into the way that we do most public funded benefits. It was difficult. It was hard to kind of, in a way, like swallow my pride and say, I definitely need, I need help with this. And it took quite a while. The application process took quite a while. And so for the beginning of my pregnancy, it was scary. That was the other part of it. It was scary because I was applying, and for it to go through all the hoops, and coupled with the impact of isolation from COVID, making the process take that much longer. You know, having to mail things in instead of getting to go to the office and directly speak with, you know, a person. Made everything take longer, and I was floating without health insurance while pregnant. which was really scary for several weeks. You know, if something were to happen to me, if I were to get in a car accident, if something were to happen to my pregnancy, like I would not be able to pay for that. And it could potentially bankrupt me, you know, or maybe I wouldn't be seen, you know? So that was really, it was scary. And it was, it just kind of highlighted for me the way that we do healthcare in this country and the way that we do healthcare, particularly for pregnant and parenting people.
Mm. And especially, I'm imagining during a pandemic with all those fears floating around, that must have been really intense.
Absolutely. Yeah. I didn't want to get COVID whilst pregnant or, you know, have, yeah, I didn't want to get COVID whilst pregnant. That's for sure.
Did you at any time during this period think about going back to work? Did you change your mind at all?
I still do. I still go back and forth. I'm like, I feel guilty in a way. I think a lot of nurses, it's like I have the skill set and I'm out of the workforce, you know, and I feel like a lot of nurses are, they're just heroes right now. You know, everybody says that, but it really is true. And when I went to go have my baby in April, I just was so grateful to the nurses who showed up to the hospital and took great care of me. And I feel kind of bad that I'm not, you know, like throwing in with them. So I go back and forth a little bit, but I keep reminding myself, like I'm on kind of a different path right now. And I'm, happy to be here. And I'm kind of prioritizing myself and my family right now. So
do you ever hear from past clients that are like, can you come back?
Oh, all the time. So like, so my clients whom I love, it was hard to break up with 25 to 30 people. I'll tell you that. Like, it was like a breakup over the phone with everybody. And it was so hard. There were lots of tears. And I told them, you know, like, technically I cannot reach out to you because that's, you know, a boundaries issue because of the nature of our relationship is therapeutic. And I was like, I cannot reach out to you, but you can always reach out to me and I will respond, you know? And, so every, you know, all my clients were texting me pictures of their babies all the time and everything. And so I would tell them, oh, guess what? I'm pregnant, you know? And then they started reaching out to me. Are you okay? Do you need anything? You know, this and that. And I mean, it just like my heart, you know, my heart, my baby is so blessed up and down. He is blessed by God, by so many people in this city. So, and then when I had the baby, you know, my clients, you know, have just celebrated with me and it's been really nice to hear from them and to, you know, continue to receive pictures of their babies and for us to be kind of on this journey together.
Yeah. That's a very beautiful expression of community, I think, where it's a reciprocal relationship.
Yes. Yes. I'm careful with boundaries because I don't want people to feel like they have to take care of me, but you know, but people, my clients have been awesome.
And so what are your plans now? You said you're in grad school. Are you planning to get back into this field in another capacity?
So I've always been kind of a creative person and I actually am earning my master's in fine arts in creative nonfiction and writing at Butler. So I am pursuing that and I'm just going to stick with that and see where it goes. Right. We'll see where nursing comes in. I mean, the cool thing about having a nursing degree is I can go work in a clinic 3 days a week, you know, to support myself while I'm writing. So, mm-hmm. but I'm definitely pursuing my MFA seriously.
Well, that's definitely a lot of stuff you can write about from the stuff you've been telling us so far. I do want to ask you, like, what is like one big takeaway that you have learned from all of your experience thus far through the pandemic. And I guess some insight you could share with our listeners.
If I could say one thing that's kind of very overarching, a theme that has been on my mind is that, you know, we've been hearing about this precipitous drop in fertility. And of course my work has mostly been with moms and babies. So I'm kind of obsessed. And we've been hearing about this drop in fertility around the world and even in this country. And when I've been just so intimately involved with how, making babies and growing little humans is, in this state and in this country. And I just think to myself, you know, if we want to support, you know, future generations, and not just to increase birth rates, but to increase the quality of life experience that all of our children have, we've got to put resources towards our babies and our children and the people who are raising them. So, yeah, in a nutshell, that theme has been on my mind in a huge way.
And do you have any solutions or ideas on how to solve that? I know we only have like 30 seconds, but
yeah, I mean, I think ideas about like free childcare, ideas about free education, those are super impactful to parenting and pregnant people. And obviously, healthcare, huge, mm-hmm. free healthcare for lots of people. Those are the things that are on my mind about solutions.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time and good luck with your degree.
Thanks.
Amy Gastelum is a registered nurse. Thank you for speaking with us. We'll be back after a quick break with two more people featured in the latest season of KPASA Midwest, a bilingual podcast out of WNIN in Evansville. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Our discussion today is all about the latest season of KPASA Midwest, a bilingual podcast based out of WNIN in Evansville. Before the break, we spoke with one of the guests featured on the program. Season 6 is about recovery from COVID-19, and we're talking with a few of the other folks featured on the show as well. We're joined now by Cindy Crow, Assistant Professor of Spanish at the University of Evansville. Welcome, Cindy.
Thank you.
I want to start with asking you a little bit about how your students got involved into translating materials in Spanish.
So I teach at the University of Evansville, which is in the southwest corner of Indiana. And we are known for our study abroad program in Harlingen, and also for our theater department. But what a lot of people don't know is that we have a Center for Innovation and Change. And actually, it has been recognized by Ashoka U, which is an international group of social entrepreneurs, and other universities like Duke and Cornell, because of what we do in the community and the larger community for reasons of helping the community, social change, innovation. So it was through that program. We call them Change Labs is the name for that. And I decided to create a change lab for any of the students that wanted to join so that we could help the Latinos with any perceived healthcare needs in our community. So that's how it got started. And when we do one of these change labs, we look for a stakeholder in the community that has some need. So in the fall semester, when I was doing the change lab with my medical Spanish students, an OBGYN clinic heard about it and reached out to us. And that's how we got started translating for a clinic that is associated with St. Vincent Ascension. So that was the beginning of our translation experiences.
Well, before we get more into the translation stuff that you guys were able to do, what exactly is a change lab? Is this different departments get to put this together? Is this just in the Spanish department?
That's a good question. It is throughout the school. And what we do is if a faculty member in any department thinks that they may see something in the community that needs to be done, or if the students come up with an idea and reach out to a faculty member, then that faculty member, or even it could be a person from the community, it doesn't even have to be one of the faculty members, that person becomes a coach, and then we list it as a class. And if anyone is interested in that sort of a project, then they can sign up for either 1 credit hour, 2 credit hours, 3 credit hours, depending on how the course is offered. And then when we get together with those students, and usually it's a multidisciplinary team of students, then we discuss, okay, what can be done? What are your ideas? And basically the students then are in charge of the project, and we just serve as coaches.
So it's a way where they can do good and also earn class credit.
You got it. In a nutshell. Yes.
I wish that was around when I was in college.
It is such a wonderful experience. And I have just been absolutely blown away by what these students are able to accomplish. It's one thing that they are excellent students in a class, or maybe not excellent, maybe just good students, but then to see them as leaders in the community and the responsibility that they are able to take on and their ability to create and all these ideas. And I'm just like, yeah, I was just blown away by this group. Yeah.
And so the students you worked with your Change Lab focused on translating materials into Spanish. What did they end up translating? Was there a specific project or was it just a multitude of things?
It was a multitude. So during the first semester, when I offered a Change Lab, I actually offered it in coordination with the medical Spanish class that I was teaching. So during the fall, we translated a maternity book because there's such a dearth of materials out there in Spanish. So by working with this clinic as a stakeholder, one of the doctors there is Hispanic, and she was suggesting, okay, here's what I need and here's what I need. And so we picked the maternity book and we translated that. And then in the spring, we were doing a map for them because it's difficult to get to the campus and to know where everything is. So the students worked on translating a map so that you could get from basically anywhere in the Evansville area to the hospital. And then also like within inside those buildings, you know, like what's here and what's there and how to get there. So so some other projects as well, but it was basically like translation. The other component of the class in the fall was to research and see what the Latino community saw as their healthcare needs. So during the fall semester, my medical Spanish students were limited because it's in the middle of a pandemic. But they went down to Echo Clinic and they talked with a healthcare provider who is Latino. And he was so gracious and spent time with them explaining, okay, here are the needs and here's our community and this is what it looks like. And then in addition to that, the medical Spanish students, when they weren't translating the maternity booklet and learning all the terms they needed to learn from medical Spanish, they also did research on the Latino community in general and healthcare needs in general throughout the country, not just in our area. So that they then presented, had a final presentation, and they have all this information. So during the second semester, the Change Lab was open to anyone with an interest. They did not have to be a medical Spanish minor per se. And then we just took that research that had already been done and the students then created a survey to be used on campus and also in the community where they could interview the different members of the Latino community and actually hear from them specifically with regards to exactly what they needed. So it was a challenge to find ways to interview the community because you just can't stand on a street corner and accost people. So it took a while, and they were the ones working on this. It took a while for them to figure out, okay, here's different ways that we can interview and how are we going to be culturally responsive and you know, to make sure that all the T's were crossed, so to speak, so they were doing everything correctly according to IRB approval, the proposal and all of that. And they did. They did an excellent job. So they wanted to be able to actually work with the community hands-on. So that was kind of the focus then of the second semester, along with translating.
And how did your students, you mentioned they ended up working in some vaccine clinics through, I think, was it also through a church or something?
Yeah. So one of the things mentioned by the OBGYN clinic as a way that they could help the community was they reached out to us and they said the regional chief medical officer is saying that not enough Latinos in the community are getting vaccinated. And so the administrator of this clinic said, you think your students could come up with anything that might help this? So we talked about it and the students thought it would be a good idea if they could get information out that would explain in Spanish, okay, here's the myth that you are hearing on social media about why you shouldn't get vaccinated. And here's the reality. So one of the students amazed me. She created the most beautiful pamphlet you can imagine, and she translated all that the CDC was saying, and also how to register online for the clinic and what you needed to bring the day of the clinic. So we produced it and turned it over to the OBGYN clinic. And then we got to talking about it. And I said, you know, I'm not so sure that the only reason they are not showing up to be vaccinated is because of the misinformation, or even because of the difficulty in registration. And that is a process, even if you're English speaking, to, you know, to do that via the internet. I said, one of the things that is pointed out on this pamphlet that was created in Spanish is that on the day that you're vaccinated, you have to show ID. So I checked, I went online and kind of researched it, and I'm reading now here because I don't want to say it incorrectly. The quote was, you can use, this is from the Indiana government site. So you can use a birth certificate or any other document that you have to show, like a photo ID, such as a driver's license or a passport. It has to have your name and your birth date printed on it, such as a letter from a doctor, medical record, discharge paperwork. The state regulations then go on to say you will not have to show proof of citizenship or U.S. residency status. But none of that gets detailed in what they hear. The only thing they have to hear is you have to have ID. That's what's on the pamphlets. That's what's passed out. So if you're not documented, you're not going to go. So, so that is what like concerned me. I thought that might be a big part of it. So my students said, yeah. So what can we do? So we talked about it, and I talked with the head of the Center for Innovation and Change on campus, the head of the Change Lab program. And she gave me the name of the pharmacist in charge of the vaccination clinic. So I reached out to her at St. Vincent. And at the same time, I thought, so maybe Catholic Church, because the Latino community is going to trust the Catholic Church. So I reached out to the Catholic Church and to the priest who actually does the mass in Spanish. And so I set up a Zoom session for the head of the vaccination clinic and the priest, and also for my students to meet and discuss, is there a way that we can get these members of the Latino community vaccinated that's less complicated, so that registration isn't a factor, and maybe so that we don't have to show identification. So the head of the vaccination clinic reached out to the state of Indiana, and she was the one that got the permission for the clinic to be held at the church after a mass in Spanish, and basically was told, we need to get them vaccinated. That's more important than ID. So my students then revised the pamphlet and put on their ID recommended but not required. And then that was the way it got circulated through the hospital was circulating it, and the church was circulating, and I'm not sure who else, but that was the verbiage that ended up on it. And I think it must have helped, because the clinic was a big success, and we vaccinated like 110 people that day we had the first clinic.
That sounds great. Well, great effort by you and your students, and we really appreciate you coming on our program today. Cindy Crow is an assistant professor of Spanish at the University of Evansville. Cindy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
As always, if you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. Right now, we're going to go join our next guest, Barbara Anguiano, Morning Edition host at Marfa Public Radio and a podcast producer for 1A, who was featured in one of the most recent episodes of K-PASA Midwest. Welcome, Barbara.
Hey, Miriam. Nice to meet you.
Likewise. So I want to talk about the episode of K-PASA Midwest that you were featured in, and it focused in part on your father getting vaccinated. What was that like? I know you're a health and science reporter, or you were at that time. What was it like trying to get your family members on board with being vaccinated?
Well, I don't think that it was so much trying to get them on board to be vaccinated as much as, you know, for me, it was a matter of when. And you know, it's not just family members. Like, you're also thinking about your friends, you're also thinking about people that you know, people that you work with, you know, for the sake of going back to your own normalcy. But I think that as a health reporter, it just kind of became even more real because you're just kind of reading, you know, you're inundated in all these stories and all this information that you find confusing. So I can't imagine how it felt for a lot of other people.
Right. And you talk about misinformation in the episode and the kinds of things, for example, your father was hearing from other people at work. What did he tell you about that? And how did you remedy that misinformation?
So this all really came out after we had gotten him, you know, the first shot. And I wish I would have known about it earlier. But he was, you know, talking about the microchip or the government's going to track you or they're just trying to make you sicker. And, you know, people that really just the hesitancy of the other people around him. And so like when I heard all these things coming from him about how people very close to him that I knew were having these doubts and saying these things, I was that much more thankful that we were just leaving the clinic, as he was getting his first shot. So I'm glad that they, you know, my parents are very supportive. So I'm glad that they took the time to look at the stories I was writing and sort of just really hear me out. On when I felt there was important information to say, you know, to share with them. And I know that not everybody has that. So that became a big part of sort of my mission. How do we, what information is important and how do I get this information out as easily and understandable as possible?
Was there any source you could track down that folks were getting this misinformation from? Like, I know I've heard of WhatsApp, you know, for a lot of older generations, they love that WhatsApp. Did you get any sense of that?
Certainly, you know, that Facebook, it was Facebook mostly. I don't know that a lot of people are on Twitter or, you know, are on, you know, finding things on Instagram. But yeah, the Facebook, the posts that I sometimes saw were really concerning. And, you know, especially when you're able to put them in a different language, something that wasn't readily available for a lot of people, that gets that much more real because now you're listening to misinformation in your own tongue and it feels that much more real, I guess.
Right. And you've recently moved from Indiana to Texas. Have you noticed anything along the way about differences in vaccine hesitancy or mask wearing or the attitudes about the pandemic?
So that's sort of something that I'm starting to kind of get into news-wise, sort of starting to learn a little bit more about Texas itself and how things work. But you know, right now here, there's no real rules for masks. The governor's made masks basically optional in a lot of places. So, you know, I'm still learning the ropes, but it definitely, the less masks I see on people, like definitely, I don't know, brings me back to that health reporter brain hasn't left. So I'm still, right, you know, hesitant to go anywhere without mine.
Right. And what do you think is the most effective way to counter misinformation? For example, folks in your life or friends of your parents that may be falling for some of this stuff, how do you counter that?
You know, for me, it's always, I find it funny how many times I go back to this in my life, but, you know, representation matters. And I think if you're hearing things in a language that you understand, if you're hearing things described to you by people that look like you, sound like you, have the same experiences as you, I think outreach is a lot easier. And I think that that's where it all really starts, you know, for a lot of things.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Barbara Anguiano is a Morning Edition host at Marfa Public Radio and a podcast producer for 1A. Barbara, thank you so much for taking the time. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yace, and Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.